The recent spate of bomb attacks in Pakistan has people on edge, but the attacks aren't stopping people from going to work.
All they can do is to just pray that these bombers don't get them at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Tune collapses at the finish.
The closest finish in women's.
Helena Kosge chose a fast route out of poverty, and we really do mean fast. She's hoping to be the winner of next week's New York Marathon. Plus, the Afghan people vote with their feet and with their phones. Afghanistan's version of American Idol is taking the country by storm. Around the world with the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. First, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. A series of Taliban attacks in Pakistan has killed more than 180 people in the last few weeks. Last week, the Pakistani army launched a ground assault against Taliban forces in South Waziristan. Militants responded by sending suicide bombers into crowded bazaars and buildings across the country. Now security is being tightened. In some areas, even schools have been shut down. Ordinary Pakistanis live in constant fear of terror attacks. We asked Pakistani journalist Imtiaz Ghul to describe the mood on the street. Imtiaz Ghul, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Why is there an increase in Taliban attacks now?
Because the Taliban are inspired by Al-Qaeda and they all believe that Pakistan army and the rest of the security apparatus is collaborating with the United States, which they believe is occupying Afghanistan. And that's why they see a common cause.
Imtiaz, you are a reporter in that area of the country. What are people on the streets telling you? Any stories in particular that come to mind?
Well, basically, most of the people are worried about their future, about the future of their children, and this is what pops up in most of the discussions. There are some people who can afford to leave this country, so they have left, but the dominant majority simply doesn't have the resource to even think about that. And all they can do is to just pray that they don't fall victim to this notorious law of averages, that these bombers don't get them at the wrong place at the wrong time.
You know, it would seem that this would turn civilians against the Taliban. How is this advancing the Taliban's agenda in that region?
Initially, people had a lot of fantasies about them, a lot of support within the population for the ideals that the Taliban propagate. And the ideal is the enforcement of Islamic Sharia, which ensures quick, speedy, and cheap justice. But what the people saw eventually that most of the Taliban were simply taking the cover of the Islamic justice system, and they actually wanted to exercise political power. So this really turned the tide against most of the militant groups in Pakistan, and they really got discredited.
What is it like on the ground for regular citizens day to day, having to live with the threat of a constant suicide attack?
Every bombing brings with it more fear, more scare, as far as the common man is concerned. They watch it on television, they experience it on the street. But then, after a while, they go back to their normal routine. And there have been experience of many people that they lost their kith and kin in such attacks. But I think time is the best healer. And also the realization that they can't get out of that place. So they learn to live with that.
It's quite amazing to see the resilience of people to focus and go on their daily routine when you never know when a bomb's going to explode.
Exactly. I think the man by instinct is very resilient, and human beings, they can take crisis upon crisis and still be living. So I think this is that innate ability that makes these people go back to work and live as if nothing had happened.
Imtiaz Ghul, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Imtiaz Ghul is a journalist and author of the book The Al-Qaeda Connection. He lives in Islamabad, Pakistan. As you just heard, people in Pakistan are getting on with their lives and going about their daily business, or their nightly business, if you're Ali Jafri. Ali is a telemarketer in Lahore. You may have even spoken to him. Ali Jafri sells satellite TV services to Americans from a call center in Pakistan. Reporter Jessica Partnow joined him on the night shift.
Lahore is a city that stays up late. So at midnight, it can seem like most of the city's 10 million people are on the road. Ali Jaffrey battles midnight Lahore traffic on his way to work every night. He works in a call center, trying to sell satellite TV to Americans. Ali says he's trained to neutralize his accent. He says it's all about the A's.
It's like grass in British accent. But in American accent, you have to extend the A. Then you'll say grass.
Ali's a dapper dresser. In the punishing Lahore heat, he looks fresh-pressed in a button-down shirt and slacks. But his face is tired and nocturnally pale. Telemarketing is a high-turnover job here, so Ali's 4 years at it make him a seasoned professional. And at 34, he's a decade older than many of his colleagues. So when his friends Ahmed and Atish recently decided to start up their own telemarketing business, they called Ali for help with training.
There are a few tips about customer service. We can't speak rudely with the customer. We have to be enthusiastic, like this kind of stuff. And we have to build rapport with the customer. Then the main thing is product knowledge.
I'm a little surprised when we pull up to an average-looking house. I was expecting a bright, shiny office with rows of cubicles, like the one in Slumdog Millionaire. We head for a small upstairs room. Computer workstations and headsets line the walls. It looks a lot like a low-budget internet cafe. Ahmed and Atish have invested about $6,000 in the equipment to start up their call center. Tonight's mission? Sell satellite subscriptions to the Dish Network. To find people to call, these guys just type names into whitepages.com.
We remember so many names, we watch movies, and if we like any name, we just put into the website and we get the results for it and we start dialing it.
Just like Hanks, Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks.
Ali, the call center veteran, searches for people named Johnson in his favorite state, Virginia. Ali goes by the name Jack Larson when he's on these calls.
Hi, Mr. Johnson, and this is Jack. How are you today?
Ali never admits he's calling from Pakistan. He'll look up the weather report in San Jose or Newark so he can make jokes about the weather. Sometimes he'll say he's a recent immigrant from Spain to explain his accent.
Yeah, Mr. Johnson, as I told you, my name is Jack, and the reason I'm calling, we are running an exciting offer in which we are giving top American 100 channels just in $9.99 only, and you will get free installation and free activation as well. So how does this sound to you, sir?
Ali paces excitedly while he talks into his headset. But this call goes like many others tonight.
Yes, American channels with free installation and free activation as well, and we'll give you free receivers as well. All right, sir, take good care of yourself, but I really don't need it. What can I do now? I don't need that.
A few seats down from Ali are two very nervous-looking young men. It's their first night making calls, so they're searching for people with South Asian last names, hoping they might get lucky and get to speak Urdu or Hindi. Most calls are wrong numbers or go through to voicemail, but eventually one of them gets through.
Hello, ma'am, I'm calling for promotion officer Dish Network. How are you? That's great. Ma'am, can you kindly tell me which kind of service are you using for your TV? Is it cable or dish?
This is the night's one very promising call. But it turns out to be to someone who's already signed up for the Dish Network.
So, ma'am, are you in contract? Okay, ma'am. Bye-bye.
Not one sale tonight. And after a few hours, it's time for Ali to head home. Call center jobs are seen as a good opportunity here, a first step out of poverty. Newer callers earn a base salary plus commission, but Ali, because of his experience, works only on commission and brings in $50 a sale. But Ali really wants to find something else. Back in the car, he says he feels trapped.
So I have no other option. Because I work in nights, and all day I sleep. I can't do anything else. I have no time. I need sleep. If you need sleep, you can't do anything.
Ali shares a four-room house with his wife and daughter, as well as his mother and two siblings. The next night, after dinner and before he heads to work, we sit on the couch in the dark during one of the city's many power outages. What's your dream job, Ali?
Dream job? Nice question. Dream job. Wake up early in the morning, 5 o'clock, and go for exercise, then take breakfast, then go to work and come back around 5 o'clock.
He wants what he calls a proper career job.
I'm getting into the IT industry very soon, inshallah. I'll work hard and I'll get classes. That would be a proper career job. I can work all over the world, not even in Pakistan.
And one that would let him work proper hours. From Lahore, I'm Jessica Partnow for the World Vision Report.
So next time you get that call from a telemarketer during dinner, you may want to think twice before you hang up on him. Funding for this report was provided by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. And what are people listening to in Pakistan on their way to work? A lot of them tune in to Hadika Kiani. She's the princess of Pakistani pop. This song, called Sonia, is top of the pops in Pakistan this week. If you travel westwards from Pakistan and cross Iran, you come to Azerbaijan. The country sits at the crossroads of East and West, and that's reflected in the culture there. Most Azeris are Muslim, but it's a secular republic. Azerbaijan was one of the first countries in the region to give women equal political status. But that hasn't necessarily changed some of the deep traditions that shape the roles of women there. Here's what Narman, a young Azeri woman, had to say.
My name is Narman Mamadova. I'm 16 years old and I live in Azerbaijan in Urgut. I want to get in university and then I want to be ambassador, working ambassador. I think it's hard to be a girl in Azerbaijan because boys and girls' rights are not equal. In Azerbaijan, most of the girls don't fight for their rights. They think about their marriage, weddings, their mother-in-law, future mother-in-law, but nobody thinks about their career. They're afraid of their families, the people around them. They think that if they do something they want, people will say that they're bad girls. And that's why they're afraid. But not like me. I don't afraid. I don't know how come I'm different. Maybe that's why I'm watching foreign TV. My parents are not like other parents. And also, I have foreign friends and they influence me. And that changed. I want to leave. You have only one life and that want to be equal with man.
Narman's story was produced by Carla Seidel. Coming up, Selena Kozge won the 2009 Boston Marathon by less than 1 second. Can she do it again in New York next week? And what does winning mean for this woman from a farming family in Kenya? That's still to come on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Defense Secretary Robert Gates was in South Korea this week. In a speech at a U.S. military base there, he said, quote, North Korea is a lethal and destabilizing force in the region. Sun Moo would likely agree, and he would know. He was born and raised there, but he defected to South Korea 8 years ago. Now, Sun Moo has made a name for himself as an artist. Well, kind of. Because the name Sun Moo is not his real one. It's a pseudonym. He's afraid that if he reveals his true identity, the North Koreans will take revenge on family members he left behind. Jason Strother paid a visit to Sun Moo's studio in Seoul and sent us this report.
At first glance, Sun Moo's small studio doesn't look different from any other artists. But then you spot a painting that seems out of place in democratic South Korea. It's of North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il, but instead of wearing his trademark gray jumpsuit, he's dressed in a pink zip-up track jacket, Nike shoes, and a baseball cap. When asked what would have happened if he drew this back in North Korea, Sun Moo flattens his hand and glides it across his throat.
당장.
If you make a picture like that, there is no need to take you to court. You will be executed right away.
Sunmu says he had a talent for painting since he was a kid, and because of those skills, he was conscripted as a propaganda artist for the North Korean military. The 37-year-old describes a painting he made that hung in the halls of schools all over his homeland.
A North Korean student takes a pen and stabs through the stomach of an American soldier, which then also goes through a Japanese and South Korean soldier standing behind him. The title of that painting was, "Let's Learn and Study as If We Are Stabbing Americans."
In North Korea, children are taught that the United States wants to invade their country. America is enemy number one. Sunmu says it wasn't until he defected that he stopped believing this. Starvation drove him to make the treacherous journey past armed border guards and across the Tumen River to China. After finally reaching South Korea in 2002, he was soon accepted into one of the nation's top art universities, where he earned both a bachelor's and master's degree. But Sunmu still creates images in the same style of some of the propaganda he made back home. Sunmu flips through the pages of his portfolio. Even though he is known as the faceless artist because he refuses to have his picture taken out of fear for the safety of his family back in North Korea, he puts great detail into the faces of his subjects. He stops at a painting he made of a young, open-armed North Korean girl wearing a pink dress and white blouse. It's a portrait, he says, that looks like any other painting he might have made before that praised his country's political ideology. But when you look at her face, you see an eerie, open-mouthed smile that goes from ear to ear. Her eyes are squinted because she is smiling so hard, but she actually looks miserable.
The girl has an over-exaggerated smile. It's a smile learned through North Korean education, and it's fake. I was taught to smile like this too when I was a child. I thought I was happy. But after defecting here, I realized that was not true happiness.
Sunmu wants viewers of his artwork to understand that while the North Korean rulers say their nation is a communist paradise, under the surface, the people are suffering. Art critic Kim Dong-il says the way Sunmu illustrates this juxtaposition is unique. Sunmu is very good at manipulating an image to reveal its implied, hidden meaning, he says. I believe that is the mark of a great artist. His greatest ability is to transform his artwork into an ironic political statement. But some here miss the irony in Sunmu's work. Protesters, mistakenly believing that Sunmu is actually praising the North Korean regime, have demanded that some of his exhibitions be shut down.
It really surprises me. I thought when I came here that South Koreans have freedom of expression. This turned out to not be the case.
But Sunmu is optimistic that divisions across the Korean Peninsula won't last forever. And it shows in his paintings that depict images of hope. A mural of white cranes flying against a bright blue sky leans against his studio wall. Some of the birds are wearing identical gray North Korean school uniforms, while others are dressed individually in various colorful styles.
In this painting, I am trying to show my hope that even though North Korean children are forced to wear these uniforms, and that South Korean children are free to wear what they want, they can still fly and live together for a long time into the future.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul, South Korea.
To see some of Sunmu's paintings, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org.
On your mark.
Winning a marathon doesn't make you a millionaire, but for runners from Africa, it can mean the road out of poverty. Take Selina Koske. Selina is the 10th child of subsistence farmers in rural Kenya. She grew up in a small hut without water or electricity, but that didn't slow her down. Each morning, Selina sprinted out of the hut, literally, and ran more than 6 miles to school barefoot. Selina is still on the move, But these days, it's marathons she's running. Selena makes no bones about the fact that she does it for the money, and she got a big pot of it at the end of her stunning win at the 2009 Boston Marathon. She won that race by less than a second. Reporter John Miller met Selena at her home in Kenya after her big win. Here's his story.
I think the best way to introduce you to Selena Kosgei is to play you a condensed version of the last quarter mile of the 2009 Boston Marathon.
Kara just lost the lead. Amazing.
The big story was Kara Goucher from Oregon. The last time an American won Boston was 1985. Goucher entered the stretch drive shoulder to shoulder with last year's winner, an Ethiopian named Dire Tune. Everyone was focused on those two.
Dire Tune looking brilliant at this point, our defending champion from Ethiopia in the front. But Kara's coming back! Kara's coming back!
But chugging away a step or two behind was a dark, thin woman who just refused to go away.
Here comes Kosgei!
Oh my gosh! Now it's Kosgei! Selena Kosgei,
the winner of the Boston Marathon.
Oh, Tune's gone. Tune collapses at the finish.
The closest finish in women's Boston Marathon history.
In a race that took more than 2.5 hours, the margin of victory was less than a second. A few weeks later, I traveled to Western Kenya to meet Selena Kosgei. That's the way you pronounce it. It turns out she's made a career of coming from behind. For years, she raced internationally as a sprinter. When she started slowing down, she switched to the 10,000 meters, but she struggled. So in her late 20s, she tried the marathon for the first time. Now she's 32. This was her first really big win.
So you know the image of there's a rainbow and there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow?
Yeah.
Well, you found the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. That must change your life completely.
Yeah, it changed. It was 1 second, but it changed my life. I feel like I'm somebody else, different.
Different and not so different.
We are going to a place where, when it is raining, we normally train there.
The worst thing a runner can do is break routine, so an hour after I got there, we went for a run. I mean, Selena went for a run. I rode alongside her in the car and asked questions.
I mean, do you get up in the morning saying, I can't wait to go out for my run today, or is it something you have to do?
It's something you have to do because it is a job. You have to do it every day.
Actually, she trains 3 times a day, 3 days a week, and twice the other 4 days. Sometimes long runs, sometimes weight training, sometimes speed work. All for just 2 marathons a year. That's as many as her body can handle.
Do you love this?
I love this.
When you train, are you in pain?
Yeah, of course. You have to be in pain.
No pain, no gain, they say.
Yeah, no pain, no gain. It's normal.
Here it's normal. This part of Kenya is thick with runners, Olympic medalists, world record holders. You can see them on the red dirt roads, running together in packs. The climate here is perfect for running, and so is the altitude, about 8,000 feet. And there are training camps now, some owned by foreigners, where runners can focus on getting better. But if you spend time here, you find that the real secret to the Kenyan success is that they work so hard and they want it so much. Selena Kosgei grew up in a mud hut, the 10th child of a family of subsistence farmers. There was no plumbing or electricity. She got her first shoes at age 14. She knew early on that running was a way to lift herself up. Around here, the nicest houses, the biggest cars, all belong to runners.
You know, when you talk to American runners, it's about the psychology of it. It's about overcoming the difficulties. It's not about money.
But it is the same with them because they also go for money. If they don't win, they are not saying it's fun. It's something difficult. You have to work for it. Running a marathon is not running for fun. You have to be running for money.
You or I have to pay to enter a marathon. Because Selena is an elite runner, race organizers pay her an appearance fee, provided she finishes under a certain time. In Boston, her fee was $30,000. Adidas, her sponsor, pays her $30,000 a year to wear their clothes when she races. So just by doing okay, Selena can make a decent living. The big money comes when she wins, When she won Boston, she got $200,000 in prize money and bonuses. That's a big payday in a country where the average income is less than $400 a year. But Selena knows it won't last forever. She figures she's got 3 or 4 more years of running left, so she's careful about her spending. Instead of buying a trampoline, she runs in place on this old truck tire. She keeps cows and chickens to cut down on food costs. She eats what she's always eaten, cornmeal mush with small portions of meat and vegetables. She drives a second-hand Toyota RAV4 that she bought from another Boston Marathon champ. And she's holding on to her $300 a month job with the provincial prison system. She used to be a guard. Now she works in the personnel office when she's not training, which is pretty rare. Her boss, Julius Adero, says he's happy to cut her some slack. Almost all Kenyan runners have government jobs.
We are aware of what athletics has done to our country. It has put our country in the map. And it's government policy to support such international athletes to the hilt.
Selena has become something of a celebrity in Kenya. There was a parade for her when she got back from Boston. Her picture was in all the papers. Everywhere she goes, people congratulate her. But when I got there, she still hadn't been home to see her mother.
Home.
So she and her husband, Barnabas Kinyor, a former world-class hurdler, drove out for a quick visit. The farm is miles from anywhere, in a rolling green patchwork of cornfields and gardens. When we arrived, we found that Selena's mother and sisters and cousins had made a huge meal for us. Selena paid for this house about 10 years ago. It's made of rough wooden boards with a tin roof. She's offered to build a better one, but her mom says she's fine with what she's got. She's just happy Selena's doing well. When we finished eating, the whole extended family gathered in the dirt yard to sing us a song of welcome. Marathons are brutal on the body and on family life. Selena's got 2 kids, aged 9 and 13. They live 3 hours from where she trains. So does her husband. She hardly sees them. When she quits, she says she might just go back to her job at the prison. That way the family could live together. But what she'd really like to do is open a camp for aspiring young runners to help them do what she did. Money is great, she says, but in the long run, she'd rather make history.
This story was produced by John Miller of Homelands Productions. And watch out for Selena in the New York Marathon next week. It takes place on the 1st of November. If you'd like to see photos of Selena, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. Not far from where Selena Kosge lives, lines of tents mark the landscape. There are many such camps across Kenya. One of the largest is called Kakuma. It houses more than 50,000 refugees from Africa, including Sudan and Somalia. It's a dusty, hot place, far from anywhere. Even the name, Kakuma, means nowhere in Swahili. Aid agencies work hard here to protect people from malnutrition, malaria, and infectious diseases. But it's a tough job with only 1 ambulance for the whole camp. Ernest Waitetu spent an evening riding in the ambulance, and he sent us this reporter's notebook.
Women gather on a dry riverbed at the edge of the camp. Some squat, digging holes to get water. Others stand waiting for their turn to dig for the precious liquid. They must all finish the task promptly. Dusk will soon be setting in, and the roads here will become no-go zones. But for Samuel Mageni, dusk means it's time to begin his job. Samuel drives an ambulance for the single hospital in the camp run by the International Rescue Committee. His ambulance is the only other vehicle apart from the police patrol allowed in the camp after dusk. I have asked to come along tonight.
We're just beginning our patrols in the night with IRC ambulance. Going out there to pick out the sick patients. Our first tour involves taking the doctors to the hospital for their night shift.
After dropping off the doctors who live in the aid agency's compound, the real work of the shift begins. Night is a dangerous time here. There are often violent clashes over water and food between the refugees and the local Turkana people. With the region awash with guns and 42,000 refugees in the camp, the government has imposed a dusk-to-dawn curfew. But dangerous or not, the work of helping the sick of Kakuma has to continue. We pick up two kids who've been stung by a scorpion whose bite can be fatal to children. We pick up a drunken youth who says he has been struck by a blunt object on the head, but who looks more like he has been knifed. In between, we pick up people suffering from malaria, headaches, and diarrhea. Our big call of the night is our third maternity case. We find the woman's husband frantically waving us to an exit road leading outside the camp. Samuel hesitates. This stretch of road is dangerous at night. The man is an Ethiopian refugee married to a local woman. His wife lives outside the refugee camp with her family. He had tried to walk her into the camp so she could go to the hospital there, but the baby just came, he says. So Samuel changes his mind and drives down the road. At the scene, we can see two women on the ground but no baby. This makes me think we have been lured to the scene by thugs. Then one of the women speaks. She says the baby hasn't fully emerged yet. Slowly, we help the mother into the ambulance and drive off. At the hospital, Samuel opens the back cab of the ambulance. There's a huge pool of blood beside the woman. I fear for baby and mom. But the new father doesn't seem afraid. With a broad smile written on his face, he tells me the baby will be called Erot, the Turkana word for road, to mark where he was born. Later that morning, the doctors tell us that the mother's life is still in danger, but the baby boy is now as fit as a fiddle. For me, it was quite a daunting night out. By 6:30 a.m., we have delivered 24 patients to the hospital. But according to Samuel, that was just a typical night. We say our goodbyes. It's the end of Samuel's shift. But before he can go home to sleep, he has to hand the ambulance to the day driver for the start of yet another shift with the sick of Kakuma.
Ernest Waitetu is a freelance journalist based in Nairobi. Funding for this report was provided by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. And in case you're wondering, Ernest tells us that the mother of that newborn baby is doing well and is back in her village. It's American Idol, Afghan style, next on the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer, and this is the World Vision Report. There's a lot of voting taking place in Afghanistan. First, the presidential election, and soon a runoff. But that's not all. In another Afghan election, people are voting by text message. And the candidates aren't politicians, they're pop stars. That's a finalist in Afghan Star, an American Idol knockoff. The TV show has become a national phenomenon. 11 million people voted at the end of the first season. That's one-third of the population of Afghanistan. But not everyone approves. In this deeply traditional society, some consider music sacrilegious. When the Taliban was in power, music was even banned. But for many Afghan youth, and 60% of the population is under 21, music has become a symbol of freedom. Director Havana Marking made a documentary about the show Afghan Star, and she told us why it's been so popular.
The Afghans are incredibly proud of their artistic, musical and cultural heritage, and for that to have been crushed for essentially a generation. People are desperate for this to be revived. They know how important it is, and this was an amazing opportunity for them.
How many people watched the finale?
11 million people, apparently, which is a third of the country. And if you consider that, I mean, it's incredibly poor and TVs are still a luxury. But in every village, you know, there will be one television in a cafe and people would come to the cafe to watch it. So it was a national phenomenon. It was amazing.
And it's really interesting how the people have taken to this form of democracy, voting by cell phone. I mean, how eager are they to vote?
It was a very interesting thing to watch. I mean, people were really, you know, debating who they should vote for and very excited to have a role and have an outcome in something that was a national phenomenon. I mean, these people that for 30 years, different regimes and different, you know, politics has been kind of forced on people with no one ever having a sort of say. And if you think that this is a sort of essentially a tribal elder society, the idea that a woman's vote is equal to a man's vote, or that people from the different ethnic groups, that all their votes are equal, that's a, you know, and the age group, the young people's votes is as important as an old person's vote. So that's a very radical and very exciting thing for especially for the youth to take on board. I think it did, you know, one of the film's things that it does show is that I mean, democracy is flawed as well, and people start to buy SIM cards so that they can, you know, support their favourite singer by that. And of course, we can't directly buy votes in the West, but, you know, rich, powerful people can pay for advertising slots and pay for celebrities to endorse them and that kind of stuff. So there are flaws to it, but really it's been incredibly exciting for people to feel that they genuinely have an influence on the outcome.
Do you think it is because of the freedom to vote, or is it the bringing back of music, or what is it that makes it so wildly popular?
It's a combination of everything. The other sort of concept, you remember that there's still conflict going on, there's still danger there. To have something to talk about, to have something to watch, is like an escape from the kind of reality of what they're living in. Is a, you know, very important factor to this kind of entertainment. It was sort of, in a way, people were proving that there was a chance to have a normal life in Afghanistan at the moment, and this was a kind of demonstration of that. Plus, the Afghans were, as I said, incredibly proud of their musical culture. And this was a way of reinvigorating and being able to sing Afghan songs, seeing them performed by Afghan musicians. So that was very exciting. The other aspect of the reason why TV has been so successful there's a kind of unofficial curfew there. It's dangerous to go out in the evenings. There's no public spaces. You can't. There's no cinemas. There's no theatres. There's no community halls where people can meet and gather. So this was something. This was a form of entertainment that people can do safely within their own houses, so that people, extended families, will come together and meet and watch this show together.
Your film showed that it's not so safe for some of the contestants. In fact, one of the finalists was a woman, and when she was voted off, she actually moved a little bit, which some people considered dancing, and that actually put her life in jeopardy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Sitara, who actually becomes the main character and who is the woman who dances, she is irrepressible. She is doing it for the love of music, and that she just wanted to dance and sing. And I think that she is inspiring for that reason, in that wherever you are in the world, however repressive the regime, there will still be people who are irrepressible. But yeah, the women, I mean, women have been killed for being on television in Afghanistan. This is not a new or sort of ridiculous idea. It's very dangerous.
What kind of response did she get when people first saw her on TV? And I'd like to know, just from regular Afghanis and also the Taliban, did they issue any threats? Was her life in danger?
Sitara's final performance, when she dances on stage, that is an electric moment, and people are absolutely shocked. I mean, you know, they haven't seen anything like it. And everyone here says, oh yeah, but, you know, she only danced a little bit. She dances enough, you know, it's definitely a dance, and that is the point. It's not a question of how much she danced or anything. The fact is, she dances. And this is still a very taboo issue. When it first happens, people are absolutely shocked. They haven't seen an Afghan woman do that, a woman do that on television. This is a sort of historic moment. How their shock turns is, you know, it sort of comes to be seen over the next few weeks. That shock could either go into kind of excitement that someone's done something different, or it can go to sort of horror. What happens is that it then becomes a more political issue, and local politicians start to take this on board and say that she's insulted their people, and, you know, her, what she's done is appalling, and she, you know, essentially put a kind of unofficial death sentence on her. Then the local people in her town, you know, the young men, really turn against her and say exactly that she's insulted their people, she's brought disrespect to all women from that region, and she really is fearful for her life. There's death threats, there's rumors all the time that she's been killed. Her family are absolutely terrified. It's an extraordinary thing that she goes through.
What ends up happening?
in the end, she's okay. She, her family are still incredibly proud of her, incredibly supportive. She goes home and it's, you know, she survives. And I think really in modern terms, I mean, people here, I don't think, you know, understand just quite the seriousness of these events. The fact that she survives is a real sort of message of hope. You know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, she absolutely would have been killed. So this is progress. I mean, you know, you can laugh at that and say that it's bad enough that she had the threats. The fact that she survives, that is progress. And in fact, she is now, she's returned to Kabul. The heat is off her. You know, these things flare up and then they move on to other people. And she's now recording an album. She's singing at weddings. She's doing well.
Do you think the show itself and the fact that these women have stepped out, do you think it's changed anything in Afghanistan? I mean, is there no going back now?
I mean, obviously the show isn't a miracle and it's not going to sort of change things overnight or be solely responsible for things. But it is definitely a tool in a sort of wide sweeping change that is happening. I think there's various aspects to its success and to its power. What this show does as well is it treats again all the ethnic groups completely equally, and you know that again is a very, very amazing and exciting thing for people to see. It doesn't make a big deal about it. It doesn't sort of, you know, just ethnic differences are just not acknowledged in that show, which is giving people a real vision of what a peaceful, united Afghanistan could be. And that is a very, very exciting thing for people, especially the young generation, to see.
Havana Marking, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Havana Marking is director of the new documentary called Afghan Star. It's playing in select theaters across the U.S. Got milk? A street vendor in Guatemala City does, and it's fresh, really fresh. Here's Trevor Snapp to tell us about it in the latest installment of our street vendor series.
It's 7 in the morning, and Oscar Garcia is rounding up his goats for work.
Rocky! Rocky!
Each goat has a name.
Rocky!
Esta era Susana, la gata.
Garcia and his 14-year-old son, Beto, sell goat milk on the streets of Guatemala City. To their customers, these portable urban dairies offer more than just refreshment. For 5 quetzals, or 55 cents, the warm glasses of milk give them a connection with the countryside they have left behind. Garcia and Beto climb a steep staircase to the main road. Their tin shack disappears into the gully below. Neighbors on the path chat and smile at the father, the son, and the goats. It's easy to forget we are in a city of over 2 million people, until we reach the traffic. Sidewalks are rare here, and the ones that do exist are narrow. Cars are not in the habit of stopping for pedestrians, so this is a difficult place to walk, and an even more difficult place to safely herd 7 curious goats. Dogs are another risk, as Beto explains. They'll cross the street to kill goats, he says. I ask, has that ever happened? Beto says, yes. What did you do, I ask? Oh, we cleaned and gutted him, and then we ate him. Garcia and Beto herd the goats across 4 lanes of traffic, down a narrow sidewalk, to a high bridge above endless slums, and finally onto a dirt path beside the highway. I flinch every time a car passes the goats, but the two shepherds make herding look easy. Garcia says this is a good way to make a living.
Other work here pays very badly, but this work gives back more. Each goat gives 4 to 5 glasses a day, and we sell about 30 to 40 a day.
Garcia and Beto make about $20 a day, much of which goes back to care for the goats. But the income is steady, and more than most make in Guatemala. Back on the highway, a TV repairman sees the goats and pulls a U-turn on his bicycle.
Un pasito.
Sí. What?
Garcia keeps the goats together while Beto quickly massages a stream of steaming milk into the customer's water bottle. Garcia and Beto don't dawdle. Their regular customers are expecting them in the city's central plaza. Garcia lashes the air above the goats with a small whip. It sounds like a gunshot. Passing drivers look over startled, and the herd moves on. Garcia, Beto, and the goats finally arrive at the plaza. Surrounded by government buildings and a cathedral, the open space is a refuge from the busy streets. Yesterday was a holiday and bandstands are being taken down, while a group of street vendors scrubbed a square clean. The goats, who roam freely, nibble and sniff curious children and grass sprouts and the occasional pigeon. Garcia has been selling milk here for over a decade. He relaxes next to a fountain and explains why his milk is special.
Goat milk is natural because the goat eats herbs and many other plants. It's good for your vision, gastritis, rheumatism, asthma.
And a sampling of their customers seemed to concur. It's rich and better than cow's milk, says Romero Vasquez, a coffee farmer. And it has lots of vitamins. It's delicious and healthy, Benita Juan, a retired house cleaner says. Goat milk is very good. It gives you the energy you need to work. And the taste is pure cream. Do you drink it, she asks? We'll try a sip there. I do. And it's incredibly good. Covered in foam and the glass is even hot. Wow, so good. So sweet. It's a muy dulce. Definitely an earthy, goaty flavor. Reggaeton music drifts out of a neighbor's window when Garcia and his son arrive home after 7 hours on the street. They are hungry, and so are the kids. The tiny goats rush out to meet their mothers, latching onto udders, gorging on the day's leftover milk. Garcia watches with a smile.
They are basically humans. The only difference is that they don't speak. We don't kill our animals because they serve us. I don't think it would be just to kill them. Our goats only die from old age.
Unless, of course, they meet up with a speeding car or a hungry dog. For the World Vision Report, this is Trevor Snapp in Guatemala City.
The United Nations estimates that 3 million Colombians have been displaced from their homes. That's because of the ongoing war between guerrilla fighters and the government. Most of the internal refugees are kids whose lives have been turned upside down. Reporter Madeline Baer met one young girl at a shelter for displaced people in the capital of Bogota. Here's her story in her own words.
Yo me llamo Paula Andrea Martín Obregoso y tengo 11 años. Yo vengo de San José del Guaviare.
My name is Paula Andrea Martin Obregoso, and I am 11 years old. I come from San Jose de Guaviare, and I am now living here in the Perdón neighborhood in Bogota. In San Jose de Guaviare, the scenery is beautiful. It's free. It's really hot. When I was about 4 years old, we were threatened by the paramilitary and guerrillas, so we had to leave there for here. I remember it all. My father taught me the music of our region since I was a baby, and I began to sing with the harp, the gaucho, the maracas. When I sing the music from my home, I feel like I'm back there, on the land, imagining the scenery. I like Green Path a lot. because it was the first song I learned. It's about when you leave your land, but then a flower that you planted leaves behind blossoms. And so the path continues growing, with a garden, a flower bed, and it is all so beautiful that even though you left the land, it's like you practically returned.
Yo quiero ser una cantante profesional, conocer más países.
I want to be a professional singer, get to know more countries. I want to continue growing with my music, study more, learn all the instruments to play, the harp, find patrons, record albums.
Since this piece was recorded, the shelter Paula was living in has been closed down. Paula's family has now found an apartment in a neighborhood in South Bogota. And that's it for this week. Remember, we have slideshows and blogs on our website. And we have details on how to become a friend of the World Vision Report on Facebook. The address, worldvisionreport.org. Our show is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Chris Baldiga is our production assistant. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. And I'm Peggy Waymire.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.